the road needed to be shipped in such a way that there would be no creasing of the fabric, otherwise it undoubtedly would have cracked, and so we had a big plywood container prepared, spread out 10 or 12 feet. This rope was extremely heavy. I don't know how St. Stephen's ever managed to stay upright when he had this around his and that heavy crown on his head. We tried them on for size, incidentally. We had that special container prepared, and of course then the bond. Then the State Department took over the job of shipping them by destroyer or cruiser to the United States. And then we had a representative from the National Bureau of Standards go to Norfolk to pick up these packages. He had no idea what was in them, but he knew. He was instructed to take them to Fort Knox, from Norfolk to Fort Knox and outside of Louisville. And then I went with the representatives from the State Department in Washington to Fort Knox, and we, of course, the Declaration and the Constitution had been stored at Fort Knox during the war. So they have underground storage bins where articles of this type can be stored in a relatively good atmosphere, conditioned atmosphere. So they were removed there, put in storage there, and the particular vault in which these relics of St. Stephen's were stored was sealed. The lock was sealed, and I had a house key with me at the time, and the imprint of my house key was among those that were put on that seal at Fort Knox. There was a story in the newspaper some years after that. This was getting, I've forgotten the exact date, but there was a story on the St. Stephen's relics, and they told about how the Hungarians had secretly taken these relics from their museum and turned them over to the American soldiers for obvious reason, with the Russians advancing. And they were taken from Hungary to Bonn, Germany. The newspaper story went on to say, and there the trail ends. We don't know where they are today, but we think they're in the Vatican. a few years later, story came out when I shouldn't remember the president who made that decision to turn them back to the Hungarians, but in any event, the decision was made to return them to Budapest, Then a year or two later, and the National Bureau of Standards in its news bulletin had a big two-page spread story of the history with the heading "Now It Can Be Told" over the story, with pictures of all of the relics, the robe and And so a year or two later, the ISO meeting was held in Budapest, and of course I was very much interested in going down and seeing them on exhibit there.
Uh-huh.
I went down with John Lawrence of SPI and our wives, and we went into the room. There was a long line of people going through that particular hall to see these relics, just as at National Archives there are frequently lines of people lined up to see the originals of the Declaration of Independence and Constitution of the United States. So while we were in that line, I got to talking to one of the guards, the Hungarian guards, and I showed him this picture from the National Bureau of Standards, you know, of all these relics and how they came to be at Fort Knox and how they were returned and he looked at that. He said, no, put that out of sight. Don't show that here.
Uh-huh.
But actually, as I say, the State Department took every precaution to that the no damage, no harm came to the to these relics while they were in our possession. But they were stored underground for a short period. In other words, the Hungarians had dug a hole in the ground and put them in the ground until they were able to contact the American soldiers and have them brought back or have them taken to Germany. But St. Stephen's, for St. Stephen's was supposed to have been, I believe, the founder of the Hungarian Empire, and they have as much respect and they were, of course, naturally a little irritated over the fact that they knew that the United States had them
somewhere,
and they were a little irritated that it took so long to get them back to where they belonged in Budapest. So that was the reason this guard, when he saw this, said, "No, put that away, don't let people see this." I don't know whether he thought they might turn on me, hold me responsible for the years in which they were stored in Fort Knox.
International crisis.
Right.
That's quite a story. Are there any other general, anything else that you think we should... I have one rather general question I wanted to ask, and it's something that hasn't come up yet at all. It has to do with the image that the American public has had of plastics, which seems to have seesawed back and forth, positive, negative, over the years. And I'm wondering, there's no image problem with stone or concrete or wood. Why is it that plastics have had to fight a bad name or bad image?
Well, actually, with stone or wood or metal, there are many failures. We've seen a lot of stories recently about the bridges that have been collapsing. Well, they are not made with plastics, and that's so. Other materials have their shortcomings as well, but I think of course the industry is very conscious of these problems of the environment and the position of plastics in that environmental problem. there, I think, well, I think we previously discussed the fire problem and that hazard, but the other major problem now with the increasing volume of plastics, we mentioned 50 billion pounds at the present time annually, and the fact that that is continuing to grow with the possibility of reaching 100 billion pounds in the year 2000. Plastics, we have always in our work tried to extend the life of plastics from the standpoint of their use, and of course that has meant that there's a problem with litter. Packaging is one of the main fields for major fields for plastics use, and there is concern over the disposability of those plastic containers or plastic foam or plastic sheet material that are used in the packaging industry. And that, but of course, in addition to plastics, you see beer cans, metal cans, I should say, thrown all over the place. So you see glass, shattered glass on the street, on the roads, that have been thrown out of cars and broken up. So, as you say, plastics have had this bad reputation, but the litter problem applies also to these other materials. Well, the industry is conscious of that. They have many studies underway and pilot plant work, in some cases actual plants that have been built to either recycle these plastic materials or that is by recovering the resin or the chemicals and reusing them. And there's also the other disposable method of burning the materials to generate electricity, which is economically feasible and is done not only in this country but abroad to a considerable extent. The problem with burning any organic material, whether it's garbage or newspapers or or wood clippings and so forth, when you burn organic materials, it generates carbon dioxide, and there is this concern about the increasing level of carbon dioxide in the stratosphere and its effect on the transmission of the necessary ultraviolet and infrared rays. So that problem pertains to plastics, of course, in a major way, but it also applies to any other. When you burn coal, you generate carbon dioxide, and certainly when you burn oil, you generate carbon dioxide. So that it's recognized that this is a problem that's going to have to be faced very broadly. And this last issue of Modern Plastics had a considerable treatment of the present stage of development of recycling plastic materials and of the necessity of having proper equipment if the plastics are burned, having the proper equipment to filter out the some of the more objectionable byproducts that mm-hmm. result. So it, other than that, I think in the beginning of the plastics industry, back in the 30s and 40s, the emphasis was not so much on the hazard to the environment, but was on the fact that they were artificial materials,
mm-hmm.
and some people thought natural fibers, cotton and wool, were much superior to synthetic fibers because they were natural and these others were artificial. But that obviously they complement each other. Most of the shirts we buy nowadays, they have a label on 65% polyester and 35% cotton. So there's a blend there of materials, as it should be. That was the substitute, what they used to call substitute. In fact, the word in German for plastic is Kunststoffe, which literally is artificial material. And but that was back in the 30s, and before the war, that there was this reaction of the public.
Uh-huh.
But
do you think that has pretty much subsided?
Oh yes, no, I think people realize now that the plastics are an excellent material for many applications. The fact that the glass and aluminum are twice the weight of plastics, of the organic materials, helps to promote the better image for plastics. But let me assure you that this is well known to the industry and is one of the major problems that the Society of Plastics Industry is working on.
Okay. I don't, except for our to return at the end to the early part of your life, I don't really have any further questions. So why don't you conclude with anything you'd like to add about your career in general?
Well, maybe this is a little egotistical, but I have, during the course of my career, received literally hundreds of letters from industry and from universities commenting on the contributions that had been made from the work done on plastics at the National Bureau of Standards. And I have two or three of those that I have selected here to indicate the tremendous support and recognition that our work at the Bureau has received over the years that I spent there. For example, there's a letter I received dated February 14, 1945. He actually addresses this letter to me at Modern Plastics in New York rather than the Bureau of Standards, which is very often the case. But this is Professor Nars Shreve at Purdue University, professor of chemical engineering, and he says in his letter, "I cannot tell you how many times I have referred inquiries regarding plastics to your magazine, telling many correspondents to either subscribe to this magazine or to refer to it at a library. Modern plastics is outstanding largely because it combines two aspects frequently separated. I refer to the technical and business sides. You do not neglect either. Indeed, you show them in their true working union. This is a spontaneous letter. I have unfortunately never actually met Professor Shreve.
Uh-huh.
I've had further correspondence with him, but this is typical of the type of letter received regarding the work that I have done at Modern Plastics. Another one that I introduced primarily because Herman Mark has also done one of these oral histories, and I thought that I would like to introduce into the record a letter which he sent me on January 26, 1946. Herman says, "Dear Dr. Klein, I have of course studied and restudied your very interesting articles in the various issues of Modern Plastics in 1945, and would like very much to have reprints of all of them," indicating that at Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn they were also recognizing and benefiting from our publications made at the National Bureau of Standards. And finally,
would those be primarily the publications what you found in Germany?
Yes, of course. But that he's referring to 1945, and you remember our publications actually went on month by month into 1948.
Mm-hmm. So he's referring to the earlier ones as
he's
well.
He's referring to the first report, the 16-page report, and to the, well, there were two parts. One was in October and one in December. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we had published many other articles in 1945. So he's referring both to the German plastics reports and to the reports of our research,
mm-hmm,
at the Bureau. In other words, he didn't limit his request to the German plastics report. And finally, 40 years later, or roughly 40, I have a letter from Dr. W. Bill Baker, who was chairman of the board of Bell Laboratories. This letter is dated July 8, 1980. He also participated in this oral history program, and I have had many contacts with Dr. Baker from the time he was active in the Bell Telephone work. He says, "Dear Gordon, I was delighted to hear from you and to have an occasion to say again how creative and distinguished is your role in the technology and in recent decades in the publication of information about plastics and polymers. You have formed an indispensable link between the science and technology of a most vital and fast-moving field of materials. I have had the pleasure of seeing generations of research and development people, as well as production and application groups, literally educated by the publications you have helped to shape." Well, I would say at this stage of my life, I can take some satisfaction in being able to reread some of these letters that have been so generously sent to me. And of course, naturally, they're not referring specifically to me, but they're I'm sure, recognizing that there were many associates of mine at the National Bureau of Standards who were responsible for many of these contributions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most significant events in my life, of course, was the election as a charter member to the Plastics Hall of Fame, along with nine other individuals from the plastics work. This was in September of 1973, and at the induction ceremonies, Lee Iacocca, who was then chairman, heading the Ford Motor Company work, subsequently transferred to the Chrysler Corporation, was the guest speaker at this induction dinner presentation. And he led off his remarks. Louis Rahm was also one of the inductees. He was in charge of the plastics work at the Princeton University, during which was the first university laboratory that got involved with plastics as a program. And Lee Iacocca, in his introductory statement, said, "My first contact with plastics came as a student of Professor Rahm's at Princeton University." And Louis Rahm looked up and he was astounded by that statement by Lee Iacocca, because I expect that the general course in which he gave to the students involved a large number of students, and Lee Iacocca was just one more name among
hundreds.
But anyway, it was a nice, everybody grinned and applauded, gave Louis Rahm a round of applause. It was a very interesting incident at that dinner.
Uh-huh. Okay, and now, since I inadvertently missed an hour of our conversation yesterday, we're going to start over again and talk about Dr. Klein's early years and his introduction to the profession of chemistry. And you were born at Trenton, New Jersey in 1903.
That's correct.
Maybe talk a little bit about your family background.
Well, my family background is that we were what would today certainly be called the poverty level. My father was a printer by trade, but in Trenton, New Jersey, there wasn't much work for printers, and so he was a salesman for candy at a weekly wage of $12, mm-hmm. as I recall, certainly not more than $14. We lived in an Italian community in Trenton. Of course, there were a lot of immigrants from Italy that were working in the mills in Trenton. Roebling's Mills, who made huge cables for supporting bridges, was right behind our house, and I have a passing memory. I was only about 5 or 6 years old at that time, the time when the Roebling Mills caught fire and burned for 2 to 3 days, and of course the ashes continued to smoke for another month, and they finally built a railroad track into the plant and hauled away the debris in freight cars. So that was where I lived to begin with. We subsequently moved to a better part of Trenton, but it was in 1916 that my father finally got a job as a printer at the Curtis Publishing Company in Philadelphia, and we moved from Trenton to Merchantsville, New Jersey, where I took my first year in high school. My father subsequently took the civil service examination for as a printer, and was offered a job at the government printing office in Washington, and we moved to Washington in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure my salary when I graduated from George Washington University with a master's degree went to New York State Laboratories. It was $40 a week. That was the beginning salary for a chemist with a master's degree. So it's difficult to reconcile such figures with the wage scales today. For example, when I retired from the Bureau of Standards in 73, my salary there was the top permitted for scientists. It was a special public law 313 position. It was roughly $18,000 a year. Today, that same position.